few seconds on the floor, dirt, germs don't have enough time to contaminate it. Parents sometimes apply that rule to pacifiers, but only after the first child. First child, forget about it. It's not happening. Ones after that, let's roll the dice. Let's see what happens. The history of the five-second rule is difficult to trace. One legend, interestingly enough, attributes this five-second rule to, of all people, Genghis Khan, who declared that food could be on the ground for 5 hours and still be safe to eat. And now the mystery of Genghis Khan has been solved. But a 2016 experiment should permanently debunk the five-second rule. Yeah. We've got parents all over this amphitheater cringing right now. Let me introduce you to Professor Donald W. Schaffner, a food microbiologist at Rutgers University, who reported that a two-year study concluded that no matter how fast you pick up food that falls on the floor, you will pick up bacteria with it. All right? You can check it out for yourself. You can go read his journal article. The journal article is entitled, Is the 5-Second Rule Real? Found in the always exciting and stimulating journal for Applied and Environmental Microbiology. Professor Schaffner tested 4 surfaces, stainless steel, ceramic tile, wood, and carpet, and 4 different foods, cut watermelon, bread, buttered bread, and strawberry gummy candy. They were dropped from a height of 5 inches onto surfaces treated with a bacteria. The researchers tested 4 contact times, less than 1 second. You got to kind of play this experiment out in your head a little bit here. Less than 1 second, 5 seconds, 30 seconds, and 300 seconds. A total of 128 possible combinations of surface food and seconds were replicated 20 times each, yielding 2,560 measurements. At this point, I asked myself the question, what else do they have, can they do? Like, is there something else that they could put their attention to? So after those 2,560 drops, they found that no fallen food escaped contamination. None. Not even the strawberry gummies, which is where my money was put, but even that picked up bacteria. And it led Professor Schaffner to conclude, quote, bacteria can contaminate instantaneously, end quote. In other words, they debunked the legendary 5-second rule. There's your bit of useless information for the day. The story we're dealing with today deals with a deeper type of uncleanness, a deeper type of contamination, one that we probably all have struggled with from time to time. And I will say, you know, when you preach consecutively through passages of the Bible, you do end up coming up against stuff that can be delicate and a bit, it has a tendency to touch a nerve. But this is my preference in how to teach the scriptures, and that's not to avoid the ones that might poke a nerve. And so we're going to look at this. Luke chapter 5, let me show it to you. Chapter 5, starting in verse 12. This is what we read here. While Jesus was in one of the towns, a man came along who was covered with leprosy. When he saw Jesus, he fell with his face to the ground and begged him, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. I am willing, he said. Be clean. And immediately the leprosy left him. Jesus then ordered him, don't tell anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them. Yet the news about him spread all the more, so the crowds of people came to hear him, to be healed of their sicknesses. But Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. A transforming encounter with Jesus from an angle we may not fully appreciate upon first blush is really what this story is about. A transforming encounter with Jesus, it's going to come at it from an angle we may not fully appreciate upon first blush. We're going to look at three things. We're going to look at the precursor to it, the radical nature of it, and the costly love it requires. So we're looking at a life-transforming encounter with Jesus. We're going to come at it from an angle we may not fully appreciate upon first blush because of the nature of the story. But we're going to look at three aspects to it, the precursor to it, the radical nature of it, and the costly love it requires. First, the precursor to it. In this story, the guy on the ground in front of Jesus did not have some minor dermatological condition. Luke, who himself was a physician, says that he was full of leprosy. Several scholars suggest this wasn't merely a rash, but a disfiguring disease. Whatever form it was a severe case, which meant he lived something like a living death. According to the Old Testament, a man in his condition would have to wear torn clothes. He would have to let his hair hang loose and untended. And if anyone got near him, he was to cover his upper lip and holler out, "Unclean! Unclean!" He would not have been able to live at home. He had to live by himself or with other lepers. There was no coming to the synagogue, no joining in public worship, no morning coffee at the local cafe, no hugs from his kids or his wife. Relatives might leave food for him at a designated place, but he was cut off from human contact. If he was fortunate, he might find a reasonably comfortable cave to live in. And so the social consequences of leprosy were perhaps worse than the illness itself. Leprosy was a sentence of social ostracism. The disease deprived victims not only of health, but of their names, their occupations, social habits, families, fellowship, worshiping communities. This man lived a tortured life. And so what does he do? Luke says the man went and fell with his face to the ground and begged Jesus, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." This was a disturbing thing for a leper to do. And people around them must have been shocked by it. Lepers were strictly forbidden to come into town. Leviticus 13 talks about this. And yet Luke tells us that this incident took place while Jesus was in one of the cities. Now we can only imagine how horrified people were as this man approached, violating every convention of polite society. People must have backed away in terror, mothers clutching their children and bystanders gasping in disbelief. But this man is now on the precipice of a transforming encounter with Jesus. Why? Desperation and conviction. Desperation over his condition. Conviction over Jesus' power to change him. Now you might think, well, this is interesting but unrelatable. I don't have leprosy or some kind of medical condition that confines me to a 21st century version of a leper colony. There's more going on in this story than a medical diagnosis and treatment. I'm going to talk about this next, but suffice it to say, leprosy is an ugly but accurate illustration of our spiritual condition. And in order for us to have a life-transforming encounter with Jesus, we need both desperation over our need and conviction in Jesus' power to change us. Now, there is a mystery as to why some come to feel this desperation and conviction and others don't. I mean, like, as I'm reading this story, I'm thinking to myself, well, why doesn't the entire leper colony go join this guy? Like, just all of you, walk into town and fall before Jesus. I don't know the answer to that question. I just know that something happened in this man that caused him to take this very unusual step in entering the city, seeking out Jesus, falling at his feet, and pleading for his power to heal him. He shouldn't have been there. He should not have been there. But he's showing us something. He came out of his overwhelming sense of personal need, recognizing his situation for what it was. And this is the way, frankly, everybody should come to Jesus. Needy and desperate for grace. One pastor tells a story about a well-groomed man in his church tapping him on the shoulder one Sunday morning to inform him that they had a first-time visitor among them. This well-groomed man said to his pastor, "Do you see that man?" Pointing to this first-time visitor. "Can you believe he would come into the house of God with those dirty jeans and that ratty t-shirt? When he passed me in the hallway, he reeked of nicotine. Pastor, what are you going to do about that man? He's a distraction to my worship." This pastor writes, "Thankfully, after the service, another church member got to our visitor before this man could. The church member himself, a recovering alcoholic, warmly welcomed the visitor, got his name, and asked him about his story. The visitor's name was George. He was recovering from a heroin addiction and felt like being part of a church could help him with that. When the leper approached Jesus, Jesus didn't say, 'Oh, no, you know, go clean up first, then we can talk, but we can't do it like this.' Clean isn't the precondition for coming to Jesus. Clean is not the precondition for coming to Jesus. Desperate and full of faith in the power of God to do the cleaning is the precondition to coming to Jesus. The mistaken belief that a person must clean up his or her life in order to merit Jesus' presence is not Christianity. This means, though, that the church will be filled with immature and broken people who still have a long way to go emotionally. They have a long way to go morally. They've got a long way to go spiritually. I tell my church often, the church is not a museum for saints, but a hospital for sinners." It's captured well in the old hymn. It says, "Come ye sinners, poor and wretched, weak and wounded, sick and sore. Jesus ready stands to save you, full of pity, joined with power." Precursor to a life-transforming encounter with Christ is often desperation and conviction. Second, the radical nature of a life-transforming encounter with Christ. When the leper falls before Jesus, he makes a request that ought to strike us as strange. "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." He doesn't say, "Lord, if you are willing, you can heal me." What's going on here? There's much more going on here than a medical condition. This man is suffering from an identity crisis. To be clean isn't just to be healthy, but acceptable. Put yourself in his day-to-day existence. If you are unclean, something is wrong with you. You don't fit in. You aren't like other people. You aren't normal. You stick out. You're kicked out. To be unclean in the Bible meant that you either did something or something was done to you that made you damaged goods. That's how this guy feels. Now, can you relate? You ever feel like damaged goods? This man isn't just suffering from a medical condition. He's suffering from an existential condition. In an identity crisis, a relational crisis, a community crisis. It may not be leprosy that does this to us today, but there are things that happen to us or things that we do that cause a sense of unacceptableness or uncleanness. You can hear the word shame within the language of unclean. Ed Welch writes about this. Sexual violations bring uncleanness to the victims. They should bring uncleanness to the perpetrator too. Unfaithfulness in marriage brings uncleanness to the betrayed spouse. It should bring uncleanness to the unfaithful spouse as well. Verbally battered men and women are filled with uncleanness. They have been told they are worthless, and once worn down, they believe it. Adopted children can feel different from children living with biological parents. Even when their adoptive parents love them well, they can hear the message inside their heads, "You were rejected. Somebody didn't want you. You're not like everyone else." If you are noticeably different physically, intellectually, or financially, you know uncleanness. And who doesn't feel noticeably different in at least one of those categories? Fall below the community standards of beauty and you carry uncleanness. If you want to identify your leprosy, ask the question, what do you want to hide? It's a shortcut to identifying the source of the sense of uncleanness in your life. So you see, we have quite a bit in common with this leprosy-riddled man. And he's after much more than physical healing. Philip Yancey put it well. He said, "We in the West are still learning the difference between acts of charity and the more difficult task of changing a person's self-perception." That's what this man is after. Not just charity, but a change in his self-perception, a change in his identity. This guy lived with the sense that everywhere he went, there was a neon flashing light above his head with the word unclean. And some of you, I know, you feel that way too. Everywhere you go, in your head at least, there's this neon flashing light above your head that says unclean. And we long for a new neon sign that says something different. The problem is, we try to change that sign ourselves. We try to change our identity in fruitless ways. Christina Kelly was a successful editor for various magazines tailored to young women. Magazines like Elle Girl, YM, Jane, Sassy. For the record, I'm not a subscriber. Some years ago, Christina wrote this. She said, "Why do we crave celebrities? Here's my theory. To be human is to feel inconsequential. And so we worship celebrities and we seek to look like them. All the great things they have done we identify with in order to escape our own inconsequential lives. But it's so dumb. With this stream of perfectly airbrushed, implanted, liposuction stars, you would have to be an absolute powerhouse of self-esteem already not to feel totally inferior before them. So we worship them because we feel inconsequential. But doing it makes us feel even worse. We make them stars, but then their fame makes us feel insignificant. I am part of this whole process as an editor. No wonder I feel soiled at the end of the day." Kelly is saying we all feel inconsequential, we feel unimportant, we feel insignificant, we feel unclean, defiled. Popular culture says this is how you fix this. Be pretty. Have perfect skin. Get thin. Look like the celebrities. And Christina Kelly, who's not a believer as far as I'm concerned, concludes this doesn't work. It doesn't work. And look, physical appearance isn't the only tactic we employ to cover up our uncleanness. We use professional accomplishment to try to cover up our uncleanness. We use popularity to cover it up. We use wealth accumulation. We use social media influence. We will look to almost anything to cover up our uncleanness. But just like Christina Kelly notes, none of them work. I think that's what created the desperation in this leper. I would guess he tried everything else and it didn't work. He owned the fact that his condition was too overwhelming for a conventional solution to solve. And so he took the extraordinary, outlandish, provocative, and controversial step of seeking out Jesus in a place he supposedly didn't belong. And yet he's showing you the way. Look, there's only one who can give you the cleansing you're looking for, the new identity you long for. There's only one who can provide you with a new neon sign that you desperately crave. And that's Jesus. He's the only one who can change your self-perception. He's the only one who can give you a new neon sign. How does he do that? We see it third in the costly love this life-transforming encounter with Jesus requires. The costly love. Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said, "be clean." And immediately the leprosy left him. Why does Jesus heal this way? There are examples of Jesus healing by just saying a word. He can do it from a great distance by just speaking a word. Why does Jesus touch him? Well, imagine for a moment what this meant to this leper. He hadn't felt a human touch in years. So what's going on? Well, I think there are a couple of things going on. First, I think Jesus wanted the leper to feel the Savior's willingness and sympathy. The touch said, "I'm with you. I understand. I love you. I care about you. And I am so sorry you've had to deal with this." Dr. Dacher Keltner is a professor of psychology and the scientific advisor, interestingly enough, scientific advisor for Pixar's film Inside Out. Anybody see Inside Out? He claims that human touch is the foundation of human relationships. He explains, saying, "Skin to skin, parent to child, touch is the social language of our social life. The foundation of all human relationship is touch." He says this: there are 4 years of touch exchanged between mother and baby. 4 years. In the social realm, our social awareness is profoundly tactile. Keltner was one of the co-authors for a study that looked at celebrity touches of NBA basketball players, including fist bumps, high fives, chest bumps, leaping shoulder bumps, chest punches, head slaps, head grabs, low fives, high tens, full hugs, half hugs, and team huddles, but no posterior slaps were recorded in the study. But those 12. The researchers discovered that teams whose players touched one another a lot did better than those teams whose players didn't. And Keltner has concluded that touch lowers stress, builds morale, and produces triumphs. A chest bump instructs us in cooperation, a half hug in compassion. One biblical counselor recounts the following story. He writes, "I have a friend who is as far from touchy-feely as you can get. He likes his space. his emotional range is, well, restricted. When a surgical procedure went badly, he landed in the hospital for over 3 weeks. During that time, he had a small but steady group of visitors. I don't think a day passed without someone stopping in to visit and pray with him. But after he recovered, he couldn't stop talking about one particular visitor. It was an older man. I don't remember how they knew each other, probably a friend of a friend. This man came into the hospital room, sat on the bed, and held my friend's hand. He held it for what would normally be considered an uncomfortably long time. He just sat there and held his hand. This older man was the first person to touch my hospitalized friend in weeks. And while my friend was telling me the story, tears were rolling down his cheeks. Naturally, that made me want to hug him. But I decided to save it for the next time he was in the hospital. Now look, I know that some uncleanness has been produced by bad touches. In an overly sexualized culture, getting this right is very difficult. However, if we throw out the baby with the bathwater, we may miss something good for us. Greet one another with a holy kiss is a New Testament command reiterated 5 times. Now, I'm not saying I want to see y'all kissing each other after the session, but might there be something biblical, theological going on that the Lord decided to have included in Holy Scripture this command, this odd-looking command, to greet one another with a holy kiss? Might there be good, holy, prudent, healing, and compassionate ways to engage in a ministry of touch like this man in the hospital received or the leper received from Jesus? A touch that genuinely and sincerely says, I'm with you, I understand, I love you, I care about you, I'm so sorry you've had to deal with this. Jesus did this. Is that the Jesus you know? But there's a deeper reason I think Jesus touched this man in order to heal him. There was a transaction being made. Jesus gives him cleansing, restores him to community, and changes his identity. He has a new life. But after this miracle, where do we find Jesus? He's alone. He's out in desolate places. He's become an outcast. The leper and Christ have traded places. In fact, that's what happened on the cross. Jesus was crucified naked. Roman crucifixion wasn't just for the purpose of pain, but shame. On the cross, Jesus is the defiled one. He's the unclean one. He's the excluded one. For what purpose? So that you might be the clean one, the accepted one, the included one. Our uncleanness makes us feel worthless, whether it's due to sexual violation, marital unfaithfulness, verbal abuse, or being noticeably different physically, intellectually, financially. Whatever it is we hide makes us feel worthless. But Jesus from the cross is saying to you, look at me. Do you think I would endure this for a worthless people? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. This is the costly love a transforming encounter with Christ requires. I want to take you back to the spring of 2011. Even in the U.S., media outlets were abuzz with an event not even taking place in this country. The royal wedding of Prince William, second in line to the throne. William had found a bride at his university, Kate Middleton. But imagine that William had gone about finding a bride differently. Imagine that the day before his wedding, he'd gone down to one of London's red light districts and plucked a prostitute from one of the brothels there. Imagine William taking her by the hand, getting down on one knee and saying to her, "I want to marry you, and I won't take no for an answer." Imagine that he'd set the date, given her a choice of any wedding dress she wanted, and then when the big day arrived, he had taken her to Westminster Abbey and said, "She's my wife. She's part of the royal family now. She will inherit all that I will inherit. Treat her as what she is, royalty." Imagine the cost William would pay for finding his wife that way. Would it have tarnished his name? Would it have brought disgrace upon the royal family? Would it even have been acceptable? Listen, it would never have happened. It would never have happened because clean don't do that for unclean. Unless you're Jesus. And this picture is a picture of what has happened to every Christian. From before the beginning of time, God wanted you. And so he's plucked you from your dirty, sleazy, desperate condition. He's cleaned you up. He's married you. He's brought you into his divine royal family. At what cost? At what cost? Jesus on a cross. That's how much he wanted you. You see? You are wanted by the eternal, all-powerful, perfectly holy, astonishingly loving, lavishly merciful creator of the cosmos and redeemer of lost souls. And so to the sexually violated, Jesus says, "You are not defiled in my eyes. I want you part of my family." To the betrayed spouse, Jesus says, "You're not undesirable to me. I want you part of my family." To the verbally battered, Jesus says, "You're not worthless. I want you part of my family." To all who feel as though they don't measure up to some arbitrary standard of intelligence, skill, or beauty, Jesus says, "You're not unclean. I want you part of my family. I want you part of my family." Let's bow our heads, let's close our eyes. I want to give you a moment just to reflect. We have more in common with this leper than we realize. There are aspects to our lives, stories in the rearview mirror we keep tucked away out of sight. There's stuff back there we dare not trot out in the open because they are a source of shame. It might be something done to you or something you've done. Regardless of what it is, we need to be clear that we're all naturally unclean. The problem is we attempt to clean ourselves up. We use our appearance, our careers, our job titles, pay raises, even church attendance or moral accomplishments to convince ourselves and others that we're clean. But they don't work. The leper probably tried all that. He could tell you. It doesn't work. But he does show you what to do. In desperation, full of faith, come to Jesus for cleansing. "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. You can give me a new self-perception. You can give me a new identity." If that's something you need to say to him, do it now. Jesus, I pray that we would be convinced to the very bottom of our souls that we have had a transforming encounter with you. And so, whatever labels we have used to describe our self-perception are gone. The only one that matters now is child of God. Anchor our identity to that, I pray. For your glory. Amen.